We're joined with Lawrence Rees, who is the writer and producer of the BBC PBS television series World War II, Behind Closed Doors, Stalin, the Nazis, and the West, which airs in the United States May 6th across the country. His previous works include The Nazis, A Warning from History, War of the Century, Horror in the East, and Auschwitz, The Nazis, and the Final Solution, for which he received the British Book Award for History Book of the Year. His previous awards include the British Academy of Film and Television Arts Award and the Grierson Award after that great famous documentarian. Lawrence, it's a great pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, Lawrence, first of all, tell us what Behind the Closed Doors is and what's new in what you're exploring in terms of the hidden history of the Second World War.
Well, I think there's a lot of things that are new in it. First of all, I think one's got to say that for a popular TV audience, the approach is new in the sense that we've seen in the past many films about D-Day, about the Battle of Britain, about in Britain here, about Dunkirk, about almost the Hollywoodization, you might say, of the whole subject, which is really focusing on the Western Front. And I think there's actually been not that much in detail told about the other side of it, which is our relationship with our ally, Joseph Stalin. And I think that the reason there hasn't been that much told about that, certainly in the popular consciousness, is because it's a very inconvenient history. It's a history that's full of grey areas of moral doubts and moral issues, whereas if you focus just on the Western Front, it's actually it's a lot easier to feel good about the whole war. So that was the reason I wanted to look at it. And also, in terms of what's new, crucially what's new, is access to all of the archives in the East that were closed under communism, not just written archives, but also the opportunity to interview a whole range of people like Stalin's secret policemen and so on, who previously would never have been able to talk openly.
Now, that was quite fascinating, because I contrast what you did with other works on the Eastern Front, for example, The Unknown War, which was done in the, in response to World at War, years ago. With Burt Lancaster, and that was sort of the Soviet response to them being excluded from the famous World at War series. And we've moved from there, including the works you've done, to the present. What kind of documents and witnesses did you interview that you felt were unavailable before?
Well, in terms of documents, the key, there's lots of key areas that are fresh. Crucially, I think, it's all of the scholarly work that's been done around the massacres at Katyn, which in fact was three separate murder sites where Stalin authorized the murder of 20,000 plus of the Polish elite. Now, this was a crime that the Soviet Union denied they committed right up until 1990. As recent as that, they were blaming the Germans. And then under Gorbachev, documents came out which shows that Stalin was completely implicated in this and signed this document relating to it, which makes Stalin, even under Russian law, make Stalin into a mass murderer. And that's interesting when you look at actually how there's an attempt to rehabilitate him, I think, in Russia today. But he's a mass murderer even under Russian law. That's something that was never admitted before.
Now, what's interesting,
and we can also see in the actions, for example, of the Red Army coming into Eastern Europe, the appalling crimes that were committed in Hungary, obviously in Germany as well, but also in Poland. All of this material was you simply couldn't get a proper handle on before the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Now, that raises an interesting question, because as you know, the scholarship of this period has been enlivened and enriched in the past 20 years precisely because of the on-again, off-again opening up of the spigots in Moscow of records. Now I think it's off again, but who knows.
Yes.
And also the issue of the eyewitnesses. But in your look at this, just give a sense of how you see the documentary form interrelating to mythology and the scholarship that people come up with, which sometimes contradicts mythology.
I think that what's really interesting is that you see politicians talk about this war, and you hear them talk about it as the great moral war. But I've heard it talk about, somebody was saying about the war in Iraq, there may be confusions around that. It's not like the Second World War, which was straightforward, our fight against evil and we won and so on. So there's a sense in which the mythology, as I see it, of the Second World War that's been taking place for many years now, but it's absolutely in place now. The mythology really relates not necessarily to lies about the war, it relates to massive omissions. And chiefly what the mythology omits is any detail or reference to our relationship with Stalin. You can see that in London today. If you go to London as a tourist, go down New Bond Street in the centre of London in the major tourist area, you can see this statue called the Allies, and it's a life-size statue of Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. It's a huge tourist attraction. And it's called the Allies, and of course, there's one ally missing, who was in many ways our most important ally, which was Joseph Stalin. And why isn't he in the statue? He's not there because it doesn't suit the mythology of the whole history.
Now, in the process of doing this, you consulted with Robert Dallek, Ian Kershaw, David Reynolds, Robert Service, who are synthesizers, if you will, of all the scholarship that's been going on in the past 20 years. How was it to work with those people?
Oh, terrific. I mean, Ian actually wasn't an official consultant on this, though he's a very close personal friend. He helped me on lots of other series, so in fact I did talk to him about it, and the others too I've known for a long time. I've been very, very lucky in that, as a historian myself, I've been able to work in this area for nearly 20 years. So I've known these people an awfully long time. These aren't new relationships necessarily, although Bob I met the first time 3 years ago, but the others I've known for some considerable time. So it was actually much more a relationship almost of friends, really. And what's been terrific is to absolutely get their input, because I think that particularly Bob, looking at how what his insight into what kind of person Roosevelt was, that was hugely influential to me in shaping and thinking about the series. But also David Reynolds has done so much detailed work on Yalta and Tehran, the two big conferences. That was also hugely helpful. So, you know, I'm someone who absolutely believes in partnership in these sorts of big enterprises, and they were terrific partners to have.
Now, what is your feeling of the whole question of reenactment in documentary series? For example, when you're dealing with historical issues like World War II, we had, of course, I guess 10 or 15 years ago, the controversy over the Horror and the Valor series, which was a Canadian-produced series that dealt with Normandy, with Dieppe, and with the bombing campaign. That caused a big furor. But what do you think, what's your feeling on that? Because that, of course, is part of many of the films you've done in recent years, not only this series, but others.
But the Auschwitz series, too, absolutely.
Yeah, but what's your feeling of the form of that?
Well, my view about it has always been, you know, if not mixed, it's been evolving. I mean, there's an awful lot of TV producers, directors who sort of get into this area because basically they want to, they in fact want to get to Hollywood. They see it as a kind of a calling card, really, and it's great for a showreel. I'm the opposite of that. I find fact much more interesting and exciting to deal with than fiction. I've no desire in any kind, shape, or form to get involved with fiction. The only reason I've got involved in these sorts of dramatizations is because the aspects of a story that I believe on television cannot be told any other way. And so, for example, with the Auschwitz series, the reason that I actually dramatized key meetings that the Nazis were having about the final solution, the plan to exterminate the Jewish people, the reason I got involved in that was because obviously there is no archive of that, and almost everybody involved in the top decision-making process is dead. So there is no other way of telling it effectively in television, in my judgment. Otherwise, you end up with a very low-level approach to this in terms of people who were much more junior. Whereas actually, I wanted to look, as well as the horror, of course, of it all, I wanted to look at the process of the decision-making. So, and it was because actually that series was received well, but then I thought, well, okay, maybe we can go one stage further. Maybe it's possible for the first time on television to actually penetrate the ultimate powers on the Allied side, Stalin, Roosevelt, Churchill, and use the actual minutes, documents of the meetings, not to write a screenplay, but as far as we know, working with all these other top academic scholars, to say, as far as we can tell, every word that's said by these people in the series was said. And that's something that I don't think anyone's ever attempted before. So even though we're using the form of drama, it's not a fictional form. We're using drama because we couldn't do it any other way, and we're trying to make sure that every word people say is what was actually said.
And what's your feeling about documentary form in general, as a way to reach mass audiences with you know, messages of nuanced and intricate and complex history?
Well, that's been kind of my life for more than 20 years, so if it was the wrong thing to do,
you're a defender.
but having said that, I'm incredibly excited by the possibilities of the web and the internet now. I think that actually the next big huge breakthrough is actually not going to come on TV. My own view, the next big huge breakthrough is going to come on the internet, because the cost of filming material and of hosting material on the internet is coming right down. And I think that younger people, and by younger people in this area of history, I probably mean people under 40, but certainly people, students in their 20s, are now grown up with an expectation that they can interact with this kind of material rather than simply watching it in long form. So whilst I'm extremely, you know, proud and happy and glad to have had the opportunities that I have had at the BBC all this time, for me, looking forward beyond this series, a really, really exciting opportunity, I think, is the internet.
Huh. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the work you have just done, I guess Behind Closed Doors was shown in England in the fall of last year?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Is the centrality in the three segments of the Polish issue, which generally you don't see in previous documentaries of World War II, certainly in Victory at Sea, certainly in World at War, and other series like that. It's minimized. Why did you sort of come to see the point of reasserting that as a central issue?
Because it seems to me that the reason it wasn't in all of these other programs is because it interferes with a central, I can say myth about it. It interferes with telling the story that it, to a large extent, the audience are comfortable with. I don't believe that anybody other than the BBC or PBS would have permitted the series, would have funded or wanted to see made the series I've done, because actually, if you were into this remotely to get an audience who were completely comfortable with it, you wouldn't touch this question, because actually, it's a very morally grey area in many ways. Certainly, I feel the British should feel ashamed about what happened and what we did. That's not a message that people necessarily want to hear. And my experience with television programs certainly is that people deal with not wanting to hear something by not coming to it. Hmm. It's not that anybody ever has pointed out, you know, any mistakes or anything in sort of difficult or controversial things I've done in history. They deal with it by pretending it didn't happen. And that's, I think, what happened to this whole Polish question. Because, and also, of course, these other series couldn't have done it. I mean, to be absolutely fair to them, these were great works, but it was almost impossible for them to do it because, of course, the archive material and all this wasn't there. And you couldn't get into Poland freely to interview people like I could.
Right.
So I've been very lucky. I've been able to do that.
So if one would do sort of a historiography of the presentation of World War II through documentaries to mass audiences, one could see throughout the kind of issues you're raising, that is that there's been exclusion, inclusion, starting from the beginning, when we look at the films done during the war itself.
Absolutely. I think that's true. It's a fact about history that people, you know, who aren't really necessarily involved in writing it or making programs about it, very often omit and don't understand, which is that you can almost tell as much from a work of history about the time in which it was made as the time in which it's about.
Right.
So you can absolutely trace that, and I fully expect that with all my work. People can look at it and say, oh, well, that's interesting. He was looking at that because of this particular things that were going on at that time. And very often as a filmmaker or a writer, you're doing that almost unconsciously. You're picking out of the kind of zeitgeist around you, you're picking out things that feel particularly appropriate for the moment. And, as I say, you can be doing that unconsciously. And also, you're trying to fill in gaps left by other work. So, for me, the key thing has been the first time unfettered proper access to the East. But also, you see, I think that a lot of these earlier works were dealing with the fact that there was a Cold War on, and the whole relationship with the Soviet Union was completely different to the relationship during the war. And so, of course, you again, you deal with a lot of this you know, by skipping it. And also, you have problems with the legacy of the war when deliberately Churchill and Roosevelt were pumping out propaganda, a lot of which I think they knew to be not correct, saying how fantastically great Stalin was.
Well, I must admit, it's the first documentary I've ever seen that mentioned the plan's Operation Unthinkable.
Yeah, which, that's exactly right.
And tell the audience what that is.
Well, Operation Unthinkable was put forward by Churchill in the wake of as what he perceived as the failure of Yalta in the spring of 1945. And he asked his military people, Lord Allen, Field Marshal Allenbrooke in particular, to actually look at a plan to invade the Soviet Union, which seems extraordinary since we'd just been allied to them. But he actually wanted to look at whether it was going to be possible effectively to make Stalin keep to the promises that he thought he'd made, particularly around Poland and free elections and so on. And they actually called it Operation Unthinkable, I think because it was unthinkable. The British military looked at it and realized very, very swiftly that it was ludicrous, it was simply impossible. But it shows you the state Churchill had got into by May 1945, which was to think that our great ally, the Soviet Union, without whom we couldn't have won the war in the way we did, was now a potential adversary. And again, that's not something, this was all top secret at the time, that's not something that then came out until much later.
Now, what did you discover that was new in our understanding of the Second Front issue, and also something that I was looking through your book that you alluded to was the issue of the secret negotiations between the Soviets and the Germans after 1941, to perhaps set up a unilateral peace. And I wondered what sort of new insights you have from looking at all this, those two issues.
Well, on the Second Front issue, I think this is absolutely crucial. And again, it's something that people do not realize. Everybody is so much in their minds got the sense that D-Day happened in the summer of 1944. That's when it happened. But actually, Stalin was calling for D-Day almost from the very moment the Germans invaded in 1941. And in fact, you know, I personally traced the very seeds of the Cold War right back to a meeting that Roosevelt has with Molotov, the Soviet Foreign Secretary at the White House, in the spring of 1942, when Roosevelt pretty much promises that there will be a second front, by which they mean D-Day, in the autumn of 1942, that early. And he's doing this, I think, basically to string Stalin along, to keep him on side at a desperate time for him. But what it does is it stokes up in Stalin this incredible growing anger about the West, that they promise things and don't deliver. And in fact, he believes they're simply standing back and letting the Red Army bleed themselves dry against Germany whilst the British and Americans stay out of the really worst bits of the conflict.
Right. I'd even argue it was in the spring of 42 when the United States is debating, you know, what to do in the Pacific. And of course, they decide to put the resources into the operations in the Solomons, but also into North Africa.
Yeah,
but it's a very...
Right. And they do that. And it's what's so fascinating is this divides historians, because you get some historians who say, listen, there was, you know, there's no possibility of the British or Americans being able to invade, certainly in 42, maybe
right.
Not even in 43, into France, because we were so inexperienced. You know, we needed this sort of learning curve, if you like, of going to North Africa and so on, to which I would say, fine, okay, I completely understand that, but why, then, are we in successive meetings assuring Stalin we will do something that we're not going to do? That's the really interesting key political question. And I think the answer to that is because, this is what relates to the other issue you raised, the answer to that is because there was a residual fear that Stalin might try and exit the war. That he's done one deal with Hitler already in the summer of 39, even given the invasion, he might try and do another one. And there's a residual fear of that, and they basically want to keep him fighting. So they'll promise him this, they'll assure him, oh yes, the great invasion's coming and so on, basically to string him along. And he's the last person in the world, if you want to really deal with, you should be stringing along.
Right, right. Well,
in terms of whether Stalin ever was going to do a deal, that again is one of the huge unanswered questions of history, and it really relates to a whole series of discussions that were going on in Sweden in the spring of 1943, in this extraordinary period after Stalingrad, but before the Battle of Kursk in the summer of 43, when there was a sort of It's very interesting. There's very little offensive operations being conducted by the Soviet Union during this time. It's possible to read what's going on as a sort of sounding out. I myself don't think it was ever really serious, even though we know there were sort of very tentative peace feelers put out in Sweden between the Soviets and the Germans. I myself don't think it was ever serious. Number one, because I don't think Stalin would have felt he could ever trust Hitler. It's impossible after he betrayed him the first time. And secondly, anyone who knows anything about the character of Adolf Hitler realizes it ain't going to happen. The only way would have been for the Nazis to have, or the Germans to have removed Hitler and tried to do some deal. But the very, you know, for 20 years, you know, for nearly, Hitler's been saying the object is to defeat Bolshevism. He sees it as the great crusade of his life, of almost of history. And the idea he'll do some kind of deal, you know, I just don't see it.
Now, being in your position as head of the BBC TV history programs, is that what you were? You were creative director?
Yeah.
And then you were involved with this show, Time Watch, starting from 1982, Like an American Experience. What were your thoughts on sort of cross-cultural takes on history through television that you saw in your role there? I mean,
I think basically we can, you know, at one level it's pretty straightforward, actually, which is if you look at what's been the biggest rating shows in pretty much any country. In Britain, it was History of Britain. You know, in Canada, it was, guess what, the History of Canada. You know, I think what you see is, I'm amazed, for example, there hasn't been a huge definitive History of America made, to my knowledge, on TV. It seems to be extraordinary that no one's not done that yet. But it's, you know, you can tell that what actually national audiences are interested in, number one, is who they are and why their country is as it is. You know, very straightforward. You go to any bookshop in America, you see all of these shelves and shelves and shelves on the Civil War.
Right.
You know, or Vietnam or whatever. It's to do with who am I, and that relates to, crucially, where am I and why am I in this place. So I think that the first thing to say about history is that what television can show is that, absolutely number one, it's to do with your own interest in your own place. And that's not necessarily parochialism, it's simply to do with, you know, what were my ancestors doing? You know, what was going on there? So that's the kind of, I guess, the first thing to say. But then what's interesting is you've got a whole series of epic kind of periods that for really interesting reasons totally break through and appeal to everybody. The most obvious is Egypt as a subject.
Right.
I mean, that Egypt is, you know, Egypt, and then following that, Rome.
But
people say, oh, well, World War II, you know, kind of rates best. It doesn't, actually. Bits of World War II will do well, particularly the bits that appeal to the audience you're talking to. So, for example, in America, that would absolutely be Pearl Harbor or D-Day. Absolutely. You know, if you've got something new to say on that, that's going to do much better for you than any film anybody makes on the Battle of Stalingrad.
Right, and they always seem to try to redo that. Now, you also, in your work, have explored different forms with Michael Wood. When see you were involved with the Conquistadores and in the footsteps of Alexander.
I've worked a lot as well with executive producing series made by history presenters. And that's also been very, very interesting, particularly Michael, but also Simon Sharma. When I was creative director of history, that I oversaw the last bit of his big epic History of Britain, and a number of other presenters. So that's also another way of telling this history.
And how do you feel about that form?
He travels in the sense that, you know, he can appear in America and appear in Britain. Mostly, what you tend to find is, again, what people want is a presenter who speaks to them, which most often means coming from that country.
Huh. Now, finally, when you deal with distribution, that is, you talked earlier about the internet as being a new form, particularly when broadband access is universal. But in your series that you did on the Nazis, Horror in the East, Auschwitz, and Beria, and now this most recent series on the diplomatic history, if you will, of the Second World War, what's your feeling about who's actually seeing this? How's this getting out? Is it an aging cohort? Is it just baby boomers who are watching these kind of shows and people who experience it directly? Does it get to new audiences?
I think, again, that's it's a huge question, and to me, obviously, it's been a question I've thought about an awful lot. You can say a number of things. Number one is, as a general rule, in every single culture, on every single channel, history skews older than other stuff. Now, that I don't think with World War II is because you had to be old to kind of experience it. You see it also with Egypt or Rome, or, you know, there's nobody left alive from then, or any or civil war. Any. As a general rule, history will skew older with the average, in terms of average age of the audience, than anything else. Why is that happening? Lots of theories about that. I think, number one, it's actually that a lot of people only get interested in history as they get older. It's like tracing your ancestors. That seems to be something that only hits people once they have children of a certain age, and they think, I wonder where, there's something about history that actually is appealing as you get older, to try and make sense of things. But there is also a younger spike to it, which is people who are actually, of course, studying or interested in it for exams. But as a general rule, it's skewing old. And every attempt, or almost every attempt, to make programs sort of, quote, accessible to young people have sort of backfired, and that they've ended up skewing older than other stuff, in my experience. So, you know, you have to accept that first and foremost. The internet's going to change that, I think, because actually, one example, we found that when there was a link on the BBC News website which skews younger than a lot of other stuff to the BBC History site, just a click through, suddenly the BBC History site was skewing amazingly young. And that was because what was happening was younger people were seeing a news item, wanting to know the background, clicking through and reading it on the history site without realizing they'd gone into history. So there was something almost putting people off, a barrier going, oh, well, you're going to go to a history site now? But actually, if you could reach it through something else, people were actually engaged with it. And I thought that was interesting.
Now, finally, when you're doing films like this, and you have a rich experience in doing documentary work starting from the 80s on history subjects, what's your feeling of how the kind of issues that you investigate when you're, you know, trying to be scrupulous to the latest interpretations of history, and then you come head up against essentially cultural mythology or hagiography that's accepted by the culture about these subjects? For example, in this country, we've had constant fights about World War II. Either, you know, people will use as justifications Hollywood and their mythology they take from the war. I'm sure that this has happened in the UK too, and elsewhere. Well, how do you sort of see these issues resolving itself? Because, of course, you get into problems where if you do something that's too controversial, such as Horror and the Valor, you can have the Canadian Parliament being pushed to eliminate the CBC. So what do you see these kind of issues saying about the exploration of these questions?
Well, I think, first of all, it's the most important thing is to make the program honestly. And if you make the program honestly, and by honesty, you don't go into it with something you want to prove. It's not a piece of personal advocacy. You haven't gone into it to show that these people were collaborators or this or that. You go into it absolutely honestly. You're driven entirely by a desire to understand and that people understand. And I think that's the absolute necessary precondition of anything that you should do in this area. And once you've done that, and you've also dealt with a number of academics who have only focused on this one narrow area for years and years and years and so on, that once you've looked at it in that way as well, and you're as sure as you can be that you are not in error, even if it's taking you to kind of an unpleasant place in terms of what politicians might feel or what newspapers might feel, you have to go with it. And part of it is that I've been phenomenally privileged working with PBS or with BBC never to have an issue around we need to drop that because our advertisers will be against it. You know, for example, you're doing stuff on Nazis, and you're trying to sell car ads. Well, it's pretty obvious a number of car manufacturers aren't going to want to put their ads in it, you know. So, you know, you can see how commercial pressures can possibly impact. I almost feel it's more of a danger about commercial pressures impacting than politicians. You know, being driven by, for example, our D-Day show is always right, let's do some more D-Day. But then we also know that's non-controversial with advertisers.
Interesting.
That's the issue, seems to me.
Interesting. Well, we've had the great pleasure to speak with Lawrence Rees, who's the director of Behind Closed Doors, Stalin and Nazis in the West, that will appear nationwide on public television on May 6th. He's also the author of World War II Behind Closed Doors, published by Pantheon Press. And I guess you're excited to see the reaction in the country to it, right?
Oh, can't wait. wait. Absolutely can't wait. I mean, it's going to be so interesting because, I mean, also I'm going to be so interested to see the extent to which people, you know, find it fresh and also are able to deal with the fact that, I mean, to be honest, a lot of it's about countries in Europe that, you know, that's necessarily been the focus on, and it's a long way away. So I'm really, really keen to know how it does.
Well, Lawrence, it was great to talk to you.
Great. Thanks so much.